You know, I think running is so complementary to a stressful lifestyle, a stressful life. The nice thing about running, when you finish, you really can't be stressed out. You can't be angry. You're kind of at peace with yourself. You have time to think through your life, think through big questions. And I think that's what gives, it's almost a form of meditation, really. And I think that's what brings me the tranquility to, you know, be able to operate at a high level at work as well. You know, sometimes at work, I feel like I have a secret advantage over all my coworkers.
That's Chris Solars, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. This is the best long-form podcast on risk and uncertainty in the world. Can I say that? Too late. I just did. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show, and it's been 3 weeks since we had our last episode, and I'm pleased to say that we are back to our normal episode every 2 week format. So it's great to be back. It's great to have you with us. Thank you for being here wherever you are and however you're listening to the show. I want to get into this episode, but before we do that, a little business. As usual, this episode is brought to you by Audible, the home for audiobooks. And as a subscriber, you can get a free 30-day trial that includes a free audiobook that is yours to keep no matter what. You can choose from over 180,000 titles. Get something like what I recently picked up, Marie Kondo's The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying. And that's because I recently moved house and it became apparent how much crap I own. To get your free trial, go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk if you are in the United States, and click on the link in the show notes if you are in the UK. Okay, let's get into it. And I try to find words and concepts that seem to encapsulate my guests, what they're about, and what we covered in each episode. And in thinking about this one, the word that kept coming back to me was mindset. My guest is ultra endurance athlete Chris Solars. Chris has set 9 world records, including the total combined time for marathons on all 7 continents, the number of stairs climbed in 12 hours, the fastest time to visit all 468 stations in the New York City subway system, most bars visited in 24 hours, and other ultra endurance world records. He has completed hundreds of marathons and recently completed the Decaman, 10 Ironman triathlons in 10 days. So, who is this guy? Is he some type of professional ultra endurance athlete? Well, no. Chris is married. He's the father of 3. He's a managing director at a hedge fund. And this is where the concept of mindset comes in. Chris has an incredible way of prioritizing and of integrating family, his passion for endurance sport, and his career. Of course, that's not easy, as you will hear. But there is a lot I think we can all take away from the mindset that Chris has developed and apply that to, well, just about any aspect of our lives. We get into all of that. Chris talks about his background, how he got into running and triathlons and ultra endurance events, some of the world records that he has set. But this isn't a conversation about endurance training. It's about motivation, overcoming obstacles, family, prioritizing and managing time, decision-making, and much, much more. I think you'll love it. And I feel very privileged to have spoken to Chris. He's extremely authentic. He's also very busy, obviously. So I am very fortunate to be able to bring this one to you. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Chris Solars. Chris, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome to London. It's great to have you on.
Thank you so much, Ben. Thanks for having me.
So this is going to be loads of fun. We've been trying to get this sorted for a few months now, and so it's wonderful to have you here, and wonderful to do it in person as well. But for my listeners who don't know you, and here's my classic, my only pre-programmed question, which is, when you get asked what it is you do, how do you respond? Who are you?
Well, thanks, Ben, and thanks again for having me. My name is Chris Solars. I'm 40 years old, a father of three. I live in New York City. My main passion is running and triathlons, and I've been lucky to have been a runner for almost 29 years. I started when I was 11 years old on the junior high school cross country team, and I've barely missed a day since. I also love swimming and biking, so for triathlons I kind of put those together, but I think my real passion is probably running.
Cool. Yeah. Where did you grow up? What was it like growing up as Chris?
So I grew up in a suburb of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I had a very happy childhood. Went to high school in Rockville, Maryland. I ran cross country and swimming in high school on the swim team, also on the tennis team. And then when I went to college, I also ran at the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay, did you go to college on scholarship then?
No, okay. No, I did not. I was a walk-on on the cross country team freshman year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and what was funny was I always truly, you know, enjoyed running. I walked on the cross country team, and for some reason it wasn't a great fit. The first year, I did my first year there, had a good time, but it was, I think, any other year or maybe another school or just at some kind of parallel, I would have been a runner on the team for all 4 years. But at the end of my freshman year, I started getting into marathons. And I found that was my way to extend running a little bit further and do something a little bit different. So that's when I started. I ran my first marathon when I was 18. And by the end of college, I had run about 10 marathons.
Wow.
And that was it. Actually, after college, I moved to Australia for a year to do a master's degree. And I fell in with a group there called the Fat Ass Runners. And these guys really epitomized the no-worries attitude of Australia. Mm-hmm. They just had, like, endless possibilities and enthusiasm. And there was nothing that was too big, you know, two marathons on back-to-back days or a 50-miler or three marathons in a month. They were doing it all, up and down mountains, all while having fun doing it. And I really fell into this group and kind of changed my perspective, because having been a runner for, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years at that point, I had really been a runner that was running for a team, running for someone else, running for something bigger than myself. And I think it was kind of right about 20 years old, or I guess that was 21, 22, I kind of really became a runner when I stopped focusing on competition. And I was doing events, but they weren't meant to try to win the event. And I think when I let that part of the competition go, where I was only focused on myself, doing better for myself and not worrying about everybody else, was able to see that, you know, a different side of running and a more pure side of running.
Sounds like it was very freeing.
Very freeing.
Yeah. I've been a runner, but not like you're a runner. I love running, just the pure joy of it. But I imagine growing up, there can be, whilst that's great, there can be loads of pressure to, you know, make teams and, you know, hit times and things like that.
Yeah, I marvel at how much pressure I put on myself. Mm. I remember high school races, and, you know, they were 25 years ago now, and I'm sure no one else remembers how I performed that day. I still remember, of course, but you realize that you're in this little world and you think you're the center of the world where everyone's watching you. And once you free yourself of that, you realize that you hardly matter at all in this world, not just about how you did in the marathon or anything like that, just in general, as a global outlook, I think it allows you to take stock of today and enjoy yourself, you know, in the present moment a little bit better.
What did you aspire to be when you were growing up? Did you want to be a professional runner or go to the Olympics, or what did you dream of being?
I think I always enjoyed it, and I think I was lucky enough to not be that good at it. You know, I think maybe perhaps I was average, a little bit better than average. The one nice thing about running is that it's not just your passive ability, it's your, you get out what you put into it. So luckily for me, 29 years later, running almost every single day, I think this is what the human body can do, not necessarily what I can do because I'm something special. So I think when I was, it was very, very modest. I really enjoyed it, but I really tried to be the best. I remember in high school, there was one guy on my team, Mike Tay, who was a natural runner. And every single week, I would try to beat him in the race. And, you know, Runner's World would tell you these little tips, visualize your race and see yourself breaking the tape. And I would keep up with him for about a mile or two. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, in like 1 second, my mind would just go to mush. And I would say, oh, well, maybe next week I'll get him. You know, and I never beat him. And I would always try to. But you just realize, you know, I think that was very humbling as well, to realize that I wasn't even, you know, the best one on my team.
Hmm. You studied finance, right?
Yeah.
Were you drawn to that particularly, or was it something you fell into, or?
I think I've always been drawn to big challenges. I studied in undergrad. I studied economics and anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. When I did my master's, in finance in Australia, and I had a job waiting for me in New York City on Wall Street as an investment banker. I think I didn't know much about investment banking then when I got the job, but I liked it for the challenge of it. Hmm. It seemed like that was the most competitive job to get, and that's why I wanted it.
Right, yeah. Right. Having said that, like the amount of the hours that investment bankers put in is just insane.
The first few years were very insane. I remember I always would hold dear my 2 days of running. So I was working 100 hours a week when I first started in New York City. We would never leave the office before midnight. And Tuesdays and Thursdays, every single day, no matter what time I left, and it would always be after midnight, I would go for a run. It wouldn't be a long run, and I would run on the weekend as well. But even when I was working the hardest I ever have in my life, I prioritized running. And some of my fondest memories in New York are running home through Times Square in 2001, 2002, you know, seeing some crazy, crazy things and just experiencing almost a nightlife from a voyeuristic perspective.
Yeah. Right. I watched one of these short little clips of you. I think it was a few years ago, but you talk about you run to work. Do you still do that?
Yeah, so I walk to work every mm-hmm. morning and I run home from work. Mm-hmm. So one thing I've done in New York in a way of prioritizing and optimizing my time is truly trying to use all of my time wisely. And if you're training for races, time on your feet is very important.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need to be fast. It can be walking, because a lot of my races are a lot of walking. So I really just appreciate any time I can walk or run slowly. And most of my running is not done at fast marathon training pace. It's mostly walking and jogging slowly, like 9-10 minute mile pace. So in the morning, what I really appreciate, I only live 2.5 miles away from work. So I have a nice leisurely walk in the morning. I'm not at the mercy of the subway trains or any type of anyone else. I can listen to All Things Risk podcast and I can, you know, and I can make telephone calls and it's free. And then similarly on the way home, I keep all of my clothes at work. I bring them all home on Friday. So on Monday through Thursday, I just run home through the park. And what's interesting in London, I think I learned it from watching people in London. I see people commuting with these big backpacks. And I think I'm one of the few in New York City that do this. But it's quite unique and unique to hear.
Yeah, I've started doing the run commute thing, and I like it better than the bike commute, which I do more of. Just because the bike commute, you have to deal with traffic and you know all that sort of stuff. The run commute is brilliant because as a podcaster, I listen to lots of podcasts, and you can just kind of tune out, as you say. You can do calls or stuff like that. It's just a way of, as you say, you know, it's sort of dead time and you can just do all kinds of wonderful things with that that time.
Yeah. Well, I found with small kids, I often use my time to, in the double running stroller or the single running stroller, I push them all over to run errands. You know, even on the weekend when I run to their doctor's appointments, even when I take them to a park, sometimes I'll take them to a park that's, you know, a few miles away from home just so that you know, everyone wins. Mm-hmm. And I've even tried to optimize my commutes to the airport.
Okay, so, I want to hear about this. How do you do that?
Well, when I am not traveling with the kids or not traveling for work, if I'm bringing a suit and my computer, usually if I'm traveling to a race, I'll fly out of LaGuardia and I will, I'll run there.
It's your stuff?
With all my stuff.
Wow.
In the backpack. You know, just like a run commute. Yeah. It's like 7.5 miles. So it takes me, you know, about an hour. Mm-hmm. And in bad traffic, you can even beat the, the cab there. Other things I always like to do is I always take the stairs whenever possible.
Sure.
In my building, I live on the 15th floor. So I walk up the stairs every single day, twice a day. You know, 30 floors a day, 210 floors a week. You know, that's like, I don't know, three times up the Empire State Building every single year and every single week. And that's not really a workout for me.
Yeah.
That's just kind of seamlessly built into my everyday routine.
Yeah.
So everywhere I can to try to build in these tiny little efficiencies, I think that's the secret. And they all add up to, you know, to a great fitness level.
Yeah. I've never quite heard it put that way. But it makes lots of sense because you can squeeze in an extra, I don't know, 20-30K worth of running per week just by doing the types of things that you do or getting on the stairs and things like that. And that does that. This is like marginal gains.
Yeah.
That makes a huge amount of sense. One of the things that struck me as you were describing the 100-hour work weeks is, you know, there are lots of folks who would have just, I think, said, you know, screw this. I'm not cut out for finance, or I'm not, you know, it's hard to integrate the kind of career side with your, you know, passion for running or whatever hobby it is. How did you come to some sort of realization that, yes, I can put these things together, or that I need to make a choice at any stage? Because you become more of an analyst than an investment banker now. But
that's right.
Was there any point where you said,
you know, I think running is so complementary to a stressful life. A stressful life. The nice thing about running, when you finish, you really can't be stressed out. You can't be angry. You're kind of at peace with yourself. Mm-hmm. You have time to think through your life, think through big questions. And I think that's what gives, it's almost a form of meditation, really. And I think that's what brings me the tranquility to, you know, be able to operate at a high level at work as well. You know, sometimes at work, I feel like I have a secret advantage over all my coworkers. We get a new project and people are up in arms. You know, how are we going to do this by the end of the week? And it is what it is. We got to do it. So we figure it out and we do it. It's quite simple. And maybe from some of the races and some of the, you know, some of these situations that you find yourself in, and then having the perspective to look back and see that you've been through it all, you know, you feel like you've been out the other end and you can do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of those big, big challenges, because you did marathons, but when was your first ultra marathon where you really pushed yourself to a new, to maybe a new height? Maybe there was a particular race or a particular moment where you thought, there's something about the human body that I can really push mine to depths that I didn't think, or levels that I didn't think were possible.
You know, there's, when I think about running, I think there's, you can go faster at a finite distance or, you know, farther and farther at the infinite distance. And I keep toggling back and forth between which one I try to perfect. You know, I'm 40 now and I've pretty much plateaued at my marathon time. And I'm very satisfied with it. But once in a while, I think maybe I could take off a few more minutes. Mm-hmm. So then I'll train.
What's your PB in the
marathon? My PB is 2:39.
It's pretty good.
Pretty good. Yeah, I've always thought, you know, sub 6 minute pace is 2:37. Uh-huh. So, but you know, there's always something. You just change the field goal. You know, you shift it down once you've achieved something. So I love to figure out, you know, can you go faster or can you go further? It took me over 100 marathons to get to the point when I truly didn't think of a marathon as a long distance.
Right.
Where it was intimidating to me. Mm-hmm. I always thought that the first goal was to finish, and then secondarily to perform well. Whereas when I finally wrapped my arms around that, you know, I used to stop in a training run at 24 or 25 for the day, simply because I didn't want the next day to look back and say, wow, I had a big day yesterday. I should treat myself today and, you know, put my feet up. Now I truly just think of the race 26 miles as another number. Mm-hmm. I did my first 100K when I was living in Australia. It took me 15 hours. It was a lot of walking, a lot of blisters. I got to the finish line, took one step, and took a little nap for 20 minutes. I truly had enough. I couldn't walk another step. And part of that's all the perspective, because I finally had done that and had never gone that far before and surpassed all my expectations. And once you've done it, you kind of check it off internally, and you feel confident that you can do it again. And once you repeat it and repeat it and repeat it as part of a process, I don't know, you just get so much better at it, not just physically and mentally, but also emotionally, because a lot of these races have peaks and troughs of emotional valleys.
You probably have gone through so many self-inflicted difficult moments that as you say, when something comes up out of the blue, you're just, you know, the level of resilience is higher than perhaps what the average, you know, the quote-unquote average person.
Well, this is funny that you say that, because I think when people always ask me, why do I do these things? I'm still searching for the answer, by the way. But I think one of the real reasons is because I'm trying to find that struggle that identifies humans throughout history and throughout the world. You know, I happen to be so lucky to be rich and healthy with a loving family and to have a great job where I don't have to work an extra job to feed my family. You know, my ultra marathon is someone else's struggle, you know, in a refugee camp in these difficult situations all over the world. So I try to never forget, you know, the very fact that I live such a privileged life to have my struggles be these artificial challenges that I have to create for myself.
Do you think we need that, though, as humans, to find the next challenge? Do you think that it's part of the human condition to seek those kinds of things out? Or
I think it is. Yeah, I think that's pretty well put. I think pain is a universal, right? I don't know if love necessarily is, if everyone's felt love throughout human history, but people have always felt pain. And you can identify with that pain, and it brings you a sense of purpose. It makes you feel alive, and it helps you withstand the future pain that you will ultimately, you know.
Is there something that you've learned or that you do when you're in one of those like really brutally difficult moments in a race that gets you through it? I mean, think about the next foot, put the next foot forward, or some people talk about, I have a mantra. What do you do when it's pretty challenging?
Yeah, I've tried them all.
Right.
Paula Ratcliffe, you know, for short-term races where there's a lot of lactic acid buildup and pain, you know, if I'm running a 5K race or a 10K race, I always go to Paula Ratcliffe's mantra, which is she tries to count from 1 to 100 without getting distracted. And she said she's never made it past 10 or 15, and I think I've never made it past that either, you know, right away. So that buys you like 10 seconds. 10 seconds or 15 seconds of pain avoidance, for sure. I think the interesting thing about these races compared to the longer races, you're bound to experience the cyclicality of emotions and pain and uncomfortable feelings. And the difference is, if you come from a shorter racing background, when you do get past the point of no return, it really is linear. So what I mean is, if you're at mile 20, if you're trying to go at, you know, 7-minute pace for the marathon, and you're at mile 20, and all of a sudden you're slowing down, and you've really blown up, you probably run too fast, and your race is over. You can walk to the finish line, you can jog. But there's no way that you're going to recuperate for 2 miles and then run a faster time such that you can recoup the time lost. So you went out too fast and you blew up the race, and you know, next time you'll do better. The difference is when you're at mile at hour 8 or 10 or whatever, and you have a similar feeling, similar low point, the tendency is to extrapolate. If I feel this bad at hour 10, by mile hour 9 or 10, then I will be out of the game. I'm going to have to quit, because there's no way that extrapolating linearly from here will I ever be able to keep going, even at a walking pace. And that's a mind game that I have to, that you have to have experienced and gotten through and be able to tell yourself that it will get better. Usually it is a few different things. One, it could be food. It usually is food. You just don't even realize that you haven't been eating enough. Secondly, it might be time. You know, I've done a few, I've done about 10 100 mile races all through the night. Once I went through the night twice in a row in the Fat Dog 120. It took me 44 hours. And, you know, you have these periods right before the sun comes up at 3, 4, 5 in the morning when you are used to being asleep. But when the sun comes up and your body clock now clicks over, even though you haven't slept for those 24 hours, it's a new day and you're ready. So knowing some of these little tricks, knowing that when the sun comes up, it's like a, you know, rejuvenation of your of yourself, as well as your a reset of your body clock, and knowing that you get some food into you, you'll be better, knowing that sometimes you need a power nap, or just knowing that you just need to, you know, refresh your, you know, your mindset. Sometimes helping, talking to pacers, talking to somebody new, things like that. There's a lot of different tricks. But really, the only trick is, you know, just to keep going.
Yeah. Have you found that, we talked about the work situation, but other situations where some of what you learn translates into other aspects of your life?
Well, maybe raising kids. You know, there's lots of challenging parts with that. And I don't know, I haven't thought exactly how this is a perfect parallel. But for sure, you know, I think the parallel is that on Facebook, you see your friends with the shiny medal.
Yeah.
And it
perfect
looks great.
Vacations.
Perfect
or whatever
vacation
it is.
And perfect family life. And you know that behind these perfect photos are a lot of struggles. Everyone goes through them, and it's not so obvious that everyone goes through them. But when you're aware of that, I think it helps the day-to-day be a little more bearable.
I like the non-linear allusion there that you made, because I think when most of us struggle in whatever, you know, struggle is part of the human condition regardless of what we're doing, and sometimes we feel like, oh, well, we're feeling shitty today because of X, and, you know, so next week's going to be even worse because all this other crap's going to happen. And it ends up not being like that, which is a great way to train what you've done. It's a great way of training the mindset for those types of situations, because nothing ever, you know, goes up in a straight line or down in a straight line.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Could we get into some of the big challenges that you've done?
Like
you hold, is it now 6 or 7 world records?
It's 9. I've broken 9.
Oh, man. All right. So what was the first one?
So the first one was the fastest navigation of the New York City subway system.
Yeah.
So that was in 2009. My friend Matt Farisi and I, we were working together, and we built a computer optimization model to visit all 468 subway stations in the fastest amount of time.
Yeah.
And there are 29 lines that make up those 468 stations, and the New York City subway runs 24 hours a day. So the you can start, the model that we built was to start at any of the 468 stations at any minute of the day and go in any of the directions. And that comes out to trillions of solutions, and then we solved and optimized and found the very fastest one.
Right. So the challenge was to run the lines,
The challenge was just to visit all 468 stations in the least amount of time.
The least amount of time. Right.
And it started here in London, the Tube Challenge. It's a little bit smaller here. There's 280 stations or so. It takes about 16 hours, which is you know, a little bit more doable than the 24 yeah. hours. So people have, when it gets broken here in London, it gets broken by a minute or 2 minutes, whereas it was a little bit less competitive in New York.
Yeah, because you can start, if you get the sequencing wrong, you could go off way into the boonies where there's no other line, and then you have to go back, and it's a fascinating.
Well, the interesting thing about London, because it's smaller, you can almost figure it out by brute force, just by knowing the system a little bit better and doing it yourself and figuring it out logically. But the more complex it gets, the more the more it makes sense to use computer-aided technology.
What was the total distance covered?
Distance was probably over 500 miles.
Wow.
Yeah.
Over how long a period?
23 hours and 50 minutes.
Jeez.
Yeah. So it took us, I would say we probably put hundreds of hours of R&D into coming up with the optimal route. And once we figured out the route, we then had what we thought was the perfect route, and we knew it would take roughly 24 hours, and we divided it up into six-hour segments, and we practiced those six-hour segments twice each.
Okay.
So we did 48 hours of training to get that route properly done. And what I did to make sure that we knew all of the transitions properly was we would be at the back of the third car from the front of the queue line, because I knew when those doors open, we would head right down the stairs, and then we'd go to the front of the fourth car from the back, and that would be exactly where we wanted to wait, because that would be the next transition. And when we were running between these cars, we were running at full speed. My friend was a runner in high school, so it was perfect. We were running like we were running for a world record. Yeah. So we made 55. It was a big interval workout. We did 55 sprints. And the anticlimactic part was like 52 of the times we arrived on a platform and still had to wait 5 or 10 minutes.
Right.
And people thought, wow, what are these guys running from? But three times we did, we were ahead of our own predictions, because we made trains that we didn't expect we'd make because we were running so fast.
Okay. How do you get something like that certified that you did indeed break the record?
Well, this is funny because Guinness certainly wants to promote their own brand. Mm-hmm. So if you break a record without any press or advance notification, they usually will not accept it.
Oh,
so they want to see at least three independent media sources have been there to verify the record. So this was lucky, because this was in January 2009. It was the height of the great financial crisis, and we needed a feel-good story on a Friday, a slow Friday. So it got picked up all over the world. So that was very easy, because we had, at the subway platform when we arrived, I almost felt like Brad Pitt walking into the Oscars or something. We got the subway doors open, and there was about 15 or 20 reporters sticking microphones in our face, all asking us the same question. Why did you do this? And if you have to ask why, you probably won't appreciate the answer. Hmm. So they kept rephrasing the question, but why? And then I would try to answer in a slightly different way, but why does anyone do anything? Mm-hmm. Why are we obsessed with riding arbitrary distances and these types of little mini goals? So it was great. That was easy to certify. 2 years later, I tried to do, and I did eventually do, the most cumulative vertical feet run in 12 hours. So you run up a building, take the elevator down, up the building, elevator down.
Same building. Yeah.
And the clock, it's a timed race. So the clock is on for 12 hours. It doesn't matter if you stop or use the bathroom or the elevator is slow. You're on the clock.
Yeah.
And this was in Philadelphia. It was the fourth highest building in Philadelphia. And I ended up doing 33,000 feet in 12 hours. And I contacted all of the newspapers. I found the Wikipedia page for newspapers and news stations. And I contacted all of them, and only about 10% of them got back to me. And some of them would say, we don't know if you're going to break the record, so we can't send a reporter, but let us know afterwards. And so I had an email sent, and afterwards I sent, and they wrote back, it's old news now. We're not interested. So I was really, really pulling teeth trying to get three independent verification sources for that one. I ended up getting the University of Pennsylvania Alumni Magazine.
Okay, that counts. Write, yeah.
That counts, you know. Yeah. And then they ultimately certified it.
Yeah.
But I had lots of attention for that Subway record.
Did you do that one on your own?
The Subway part? Was with a friend. The stair climb was alone.
Right. Yeah. Did you have a crew? Or
oh, I had a whole crew.
Yeah, okay.
And my wife is the always behind the scenes at all of these events for me. And she was there in the elevator. We had a table set up with all my food and drinks, and she was giving me massage. And it was great. You know, I had everything, and we also need to get witness. So you asked, how does Guinness certify these records? They want at least three independent media sources. They want three witness letters of people who are of upstanding prominence in the community. They also want witness signatures of all the people who've been there. And I give them usually 50 to 100. So I had people come and run with me. People who were passing the building just signed out of interest. So we had hundreds of signatures. We also had hundreds of photographs and video clips and all of these things. So you put all these things together in a big package, and it's sufficient.
Wow, that sounds like a great endeavor. On that one, was there something that struck you? Like, did you look at the Guinness Book of World Records and say, "Hey, I wonder which one I can break"? Like, how do you think
that's how it started.
Yeah.
And I found a lot that I can break, and I've been very selective. So all of the records that I've chosen to attempt, and I guess luckily I've succeeded in all of them, mm-hmm. That I've chosen to attempt, I felt very attached to all of them.
Yeah.
You know, it took a while. There's some, you know, first of all, they're all silly, because if it were a true world record, it would be an Olympic sport, perhaps, yeah. And I'd be competing against Kipchoge in the marathon. If the 12-hour stair climb were an Olympic event, the record wouldn't have been 33,000 feet.
Yeah.
But you know, having said that, there's even within the silliness of Guinness records, there are some very silly records, of which just don't interest me.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I'm not up for the longest fingernail challenge or whatever it is these days.
No.
But yeah, it's but you don't set out to do this. We were talking before we got recording. You don't strike me as someone who's doing this for any sort of ego purpose at all. It's quite the opposite. There's something. Are you internally motivated or externally motivated, would you say?
Well, I mean, I think the obvious answer is internally motivated. I mean, it's certainly, I can't deny that it's nice to be invited on a podcast and have my ego boosted that, you know, I'm some kind of great athlete. But I think I would be doing this anyway, for sure. I really, really enjoy the process. I think I enjoy the process of training even more than the success of the results. And I think that's why I've perpetually almost always have multiple events on the calendar, something to look forward to. Because you do get this almost after the fact, you know, after the big race is over, it's kind of like, well, what's next?
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends, I've seen my friends and I've seen myself kind of go in a mini funk.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, your big race is over. Like, what's the point of, I remember after my first 100 mile race in 2006, it took me months, probably 5-6 months to get back into a running routine.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's the point of running 6 miles before work when you've just done 100? It just seemed pointless. And in fact, I almost thought that I would never get my bug back, you know, my edge back, the motivation that gets me up like early in the morning. I think, so I don't really know where I find it from sometimes because I don't truly believe that I have outstanding willpower. But when everything comes together for a big event, I act as if I have great willpower in the sense that when I have this tunnel vision before a big event, my diet is perfect. My sleeping, everything is about maximizing perfect sleep. And my training is perfect. And it's not like I'm tempted to have dessert. I truly don't want it. I don't want to drop a beer. And I kind of love that. Sometimes I'm happiest then. It's like a It's like a workhorse who's, you know, super happy because I feel like a noble warrior, like all focused on that. And I do it with respect to, you know, my job and my, and of course my family and job come before these events. But it is easy enough to balance all three, and that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, I think something to be said for always having something to look forward to or to train, and maybe even to know what the next thing might be, even if it's a vague notion after the whatever the thing is that you've just completed.
Yeah,
because then it becomes, you know, what you've completed is just, it's a thing, it's a good thing, but it's not, you know, the thing.
Well, I remember when I was in college, I did my first Ironman, and I can remember swimming at my local pool in Rockville. I just remember swimming up and down at the laps, and just remember just being giddy at the idea of doing something so audacious. And I thought, you know, if I can do that, you know, that'll be it. Mm-hmm. I can check that off my box and feel so satisfied that I did the Ironman. And this was in 1999, before it was such a big deal, I think. And, you know, it took me 10 years. It was such a hard event for me. It took me 10 years to come back to the Ironman. I think I did it again in 2006, and I've done it many times since. And 5 years ago, I did the double Ironman. Hmm. And that was a 4.8-mile swim, 224-mile bike, and then a 52-mile run all together.
This was the double Ironman, not the Ultraman.
Not the Ultraman. Yeah, this was the double Ironman. And it took me 33 or 34 hours nonstop. And I remember up before that event, I can just remember how I felt before that event, thinking, is it too audacious? Can I really do it? And then now that I've done that, I went on to do the quintuple Ironman, the epic five. And then I did it again last year. So I've now done the quintuple Ironman twice. Wow. And it just puts everything in perspective, because 20 years ago, I truly didn't know if I could do the single Ironman. And now I have my sights on the Decaman, which is one day for 10 days in a row, which is going to be next month.
Where is that going to be?
So that's in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It's the first time they're holding a big race like this, the Decaman, in the U.S. Historically, there's been one in Mexico. There's been a few in Europe here. But it's a big event, and it's going to be the biggest one ever held. So they have 50 competitors across three different events within the event. But my event is going to be one Ironman a day for 10 days.
Okay. So everyone starts at the same time each day.
That's right.
And is it on the same course each day?
It's the same course. It's Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
It's triathlon Groundhog Day. Yeah. And it sounds very daunting if you don't like this kind of thing, but it's a lap course in a lake back a few times.
Yeah.
The bike course is a 7-mile bike loop. So you do that 16 times. And then the run course, get this, is just half a mile.
Oh, man.
You do the run course, you know, all back and forth. And
yeah, I don't know.
So here's the good things.
Yeah.
The good thing is you don't have to think about getting lost.
Yes.
You don't have to think about where your food is, your support, medical attention, or camaraderie on the course.
Yes.
There's going to be people surrounding
all
you
the
whole time.
Yes.
So those are the good things. The daunting things are, you know, for 10 days, I'm going to be just in one tiny little park in New Orleans, which, you know, perhaps you don't see as much as you would if it were another kind of 1,400-mile race that explored, you know, half the country. But that's the trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
That's the trade-off. But it's very exciting because I've never done something 10 days long, 5 days long twice.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, you know, it's the next level for me. It's almost like the next drug, you know, it's a harder drug, and I'm just slowly going down that slippery slope.
What's the community like of people that do these sorts of things?
Oh, so supportive.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I have met people on one day in one event or over one weekend, and I feel like they're a brother. You know, we shared in misery, and it's that collective consciousness of suffering together that kind of brought us together. So I have a lot of friends that, when I think about it, I really don't know them that well. We've shared a few experiences in races over the years, but people are so supportive. And at these races in particular, there might be one or two guys who are really going going for the win. But everyone else is supportive of each other, which is very different than the triathlon community in general. Yeah. You go to the New York City triathlon and everyone is out for blood. Mm-hmm. It's very, very competitive. And in fact, I don't like the triathlon scene in general.
I did my first triathlon earlier this year, and it was a little bit like that. There were, I don't know how many thousands of people. It was the London Triathlon, and the swim was filled with people, you know, swimming over you and all the rest of it. Some folks were very obsessed with their time and their performance, even though, you know, there are no prizes.
That's right.
So you just wonder. And you also see things like in amateur cycling here, masters competitions, doping. You hear about people getting caught for doping and things like this. And again, there are no prizes, or people aren't doing this professionally. And you do wonder. Which is different from, you know, everything I know about the sort of ultra community. It's the other direction completely.
That's right. The camaraderie is very strong. The aid stations, the volunteers, people are great.
Yeah.
It's a nice little community.
Having said that, I know that all of these things require a huge amount of, you know, time commitment, and there are folks that get so absorbed into it that the rest of their life suffers, like the family life suffers, the professional life suffers. You've been able to, I don't want to use the word balance, but you've been able to keep that sense of harmony around that.
I'm trying. It's tough because I do constantly think about the trade-offs. Mm-hmm. You know, a long bike ride on Saturday morning could be time spent with the kids. I always think to this stat that I read that 95% of the time you'll ever spend with your kids is before they turn 14 years old. Mm. And, you know, that's what I'm dealing with right now. I have 3 kids, 6, 4, and 2, and it's a tough balance. So I always try to run in the morning before they get up. Usually on the weekends, one morning I'll be gone for most of the morning. But it's a tough balance. It's a tough balance to figure out exactly how to be the best person that I could be and be the happiest that I can be. So it's all a balance, but I'm working on it.
Yeah.
I may make it look easy, but sometimes it's not.
Well, I think we all struggle with this in one shape or form, even if it's not, you know, ultra endurance challenges. What strikes me is you're very purposeful in what you're doing. So I think many of us who don't or aren't as, you know, quite as purposeful in terms of spending the time in a kind of quality way.
Yeah. Well, the one I really do try to cut out all of the things that aren't important.
Yeah. You don't strike me as someone who watches television or, you know, surfs the internet meaninglessly.
Well, I do surf the internet, hopefully meaningfully. The one thing I do whenever I watch, so I run on the treadmill at home a lot.
Right.
And my trick there is that when I watched Game of Thrones, which I watched religiously, when I watched Breaking Bad, it was all while I was running
while
on the
you're
treadmill.
Running. Yeah.
So there's been nights when I watch one episode and I'm, you know, you got to watch the next one. And if you make that commitment to yourself that you're only going to do it when you're running, what a benefit. You're going to be running a lot. You run 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. So that's been really, really good. That's been one of my big secrets that I've really held on to.
Yeah, that's so awesome. It's a great lesson. Before, I don't want to get into every single one of your world records, but the one that does intrigue me is the marathons in the 7 continents.
Yeah,
the fastest time. Particularly the Antarctica leg of that. Like, how did you do that?
Well, the Antarctica marathon trip was one of the best trips I've ever taken, and again, I feel quite lucky to even be able to say that. Because so few people have ever gone. It was a 2-week trip where you see dozens of penguin colonies and icebergs, and you visit a research base. On board, there were PhD scientists that talk about global warming and Antarctic history and a bird expert. So every single day we were presented with something else. And it was, by the end of the trip, it was almost like the marathon day was almost an afterthought of this amazing, beautiful experience. Not to mention sharing it with 100 runners, who many of them who are still friends today, you know, 8 years later. So it was great. When I first heard that you could run a marathon in Antarctica, I didn't even know you could visit Antarctica really as a tourist. Mm-hmm. There's a waiting list, so it takes now, I think it took me 3 years to get off the waiting list back in 2011, and I think it's even longer now. But it was a fantastic experience. It was on what's called King George Island, which is almost 450 miles north of the South Pole. So on that particular day in Feb, it was colder in New York City than it was in Antarctica, because it was the Antarctic summer.
It was the summer.
And the conditions that I thought I was going to have to battle with, you know, sideways snow and ice, were the exact opposite. It was, in fact, muddy, because it was like 33 degrees, and it was a little bit wet, and wind. And it was almost like a muddy trail race. And it was on a research base that had five miles of road. So they just did the best they could. The course itself was not necessarily scenic, but the whole trip was amazing. So we did you do the course five times, plus a little out and back or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you hit all the other continents, obviously.
Yeah.
How many marathons now have you done in total?
I've run over 300.
Oh, wow.
In about 50 different countries. So
do you have, besides the Antarctica one, do you have one or two that really stick out as very interesting? Or
so many just to name a few: the Easter Island Marathon off the coast of Chile with the big moai heads was beautiful. I really in the U.S. there's some small races that I've really enjoyed. The Crater Lake Marathon in Oregon was beautiful. In Norway, within the Arctic Circle, there's called the Arctic Circle Marathon that starts at midnight, on the night of the midnight sun. So that was amazing too. There's been many races. In less than 2 weeks, the New York City Marathon is coming up.
Yes.
It'll be my 15th in a row.
Oh, wow.
And I think it has to be my favorite. It's the most spectacular of all. It's the biggest every year. They break a record almost every year with the most participants, over 50,000, over 2 million spectators through all five boroughs. Mm-hmm. I have probably over 100 friends who will be running. So it's kind of like the New York City running scene's Olympics. So I always look forward to that one. And I run that race with my wife every year. So this will be her 11th year.
Wow. So that's a great way of spending quality time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, we've both been quite busy these past few weeks, so I haven't seen her all that much. But we're going to have the whole day. Yeah. We'll have the whole day together, which will be nice.
Yeah, that's so awesome. Excellent. Well, before we transition to a couple of other things, I did want to just, after Decaman, what's next? And, you know, you're doing Paris, I know that.
So we've talked about that. I love, when I first heard about Paris, the 1,250K bike race in 3 days, I thought it was way too daunting. You know, 750 miles just seems impossible, when a 100-mile century ride feels impossible sometimes. I've read a lot of reports and met many people who've talked about this race. People talk about it like a before and after moment in their lives, like it's like a big revelation, like it changes their whole outlook on life and their perspective. I think it is so hard and life affirming. So I feel like over the four, it only happens every 4 years as well, and there's so much history with this race, because it's older than the Tour de France. It's been around for three centuries. So few people do it. And people write about it with reverence, you know, the history of it all. And to be a part of it is exciting. But 4 years ago, I wasn't mentally ready. I didn't think I could do it. And now I have the audacity to think that I can finish it. And perhaps that's what you need. You need to just keep going. Because you know, I did a 300K ride a few weeks ago in getting ready for the Decaman next month. And when I was done with that, it took me 13 hours. I was exhausted. And I slept for, you know, 9 hours that night. And the next day I felt groggy. But, you know, that's just a dent in the PPP.
I mean, based on what you've done, even though it's a different discipline, I'm sure you'll be, you know, absolutely fine on the bike. But it is a different, I mean, obviously it's a different sport, and there's a different feeling in cycling versus running.
Yeah. Well, you have to be, I think with cycling, you have to have all your senses about you.
You do, yeah.
It's more dangerous than running. You're riding at night. You're riding with other riders who are also tired. There's a lot of different variables there. But after PBP, the two running races that I've, you know, I guess when I first started, I never thought that I would be able to even consider doing them. And now they're on my radar are the Badwater 135-mile race in Death Valley and the Spartathlon in Greece.
Oh, awesome.
So the Spartathlon is, you know, 153-mile race.
Yes.
From Athens to Sparta.
Yes.
And that allegedly, or, you know, supposedly was the real story of how Pheidippides died. He didn't die running 26
no.
miles. He died running 153
right.
miles. And what makes it so tough is that they have a strict 36-hour cutoff.
Oh, wow.
Because in the writings, Herodotus said that it took him a day and a half. So they made it 36. So you have to beat Pheidippides, a professional Greek runner.
Right. the professional messenger. I did the Athens marathon, which is great. But I also had in the back of my mind, this wasn't the real deal, the really hard one. But that's awesome. It sounds like you're going to be continuing to kind of play this game of like harmonizing your time. To make it all sort of fit and work,
I hope so.
Which is, you know, it seems to have worked in spite of its challenges. I did want to transition a little bit and talk about your views on decision making and uncertainty, which is a kind of a theme that's been cropping up and that's been on the forefront of my mind. And how do you make tough decisions? Do you find that, you know, in doing the types of things that you've done, that you've made a conscious decision to do these events, to do these races, or did something propel you to do them, or maybe there's another approach that you take to tough decisions? It may not be related to choosing what next challenge you have, but it might be something professional. It might be something.
Yeah.
Something completely different.
I think my approach to my training is the same as my approach to decision making and work, which is really the same as my outlook on life, which is preparation. And doing everything you can to get ready for the big day is probably the most important. There's a Navy SEAL motto that says, "The more you sweat in peacetime, the less you bleed in wartime." I love that. I've kind of adopted that as my personal motto. The Kenyans have a similar strategy: train hard, win easy. And you know, there's another phrase that comes up a lot, like prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And I actually think this is exactly wrong. I mean, there's no hope. You know, hoping is futile. Like, it's the antithesis of preparation. Like, you should spend all your time hoping. Planning a little bit better, right? Using all that time to completely plan, and that preparation gives you the confidence on the big day. So these are some of the things I try to do, is meticulously plan out all of the worst case scenarios. And in the race, you know, you can think, it's easy to think through everything in a race, because this is a finite controlled environment. So you plan out what you're going to eat, you plan out what you're going to wear, what you're going to drink. What happens if you get really tired? You can always pull the plug. You can always quit. You know, there's no shame in that if you decide to do that. And then having done it 300 times in the marathon, it becomes routine. And I think that's my edge, is making practicing so well that everything becomes routine. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the decision-making techniques that I've used.
Mm-hmm. I think those are very powerful. And even if things don't translate from one scenario to the next, I think just going through that process of thinking through, but also maybe subjecting yourself to those difficult moments and just saying, hey, you know, I've been through a lot worse than what might be happening now. What about suffering in the Decaman, for example? You know, day 7, day 8, day 9. How do you think? Have you thought through some of those?
This is half of the training, I think.
Is
preparing myself for November 8th through 17th, mm-hmm. and realizing that is my time to suffer, maybe for lack of a better word. But it will be a lot of fun. The truth is, it will be a grand adventure. But I know there's going to be some dark moments. But that's the time to step it up. So a lot of my training, I've been trying to get in 20 hours a week. Since August, I've been successful with that. And a lot of the time is thinking about how I'm going to feel at certain points in the race and knowing that it's going to be tough. One thing about the ultra triathlons that perhaps makes it a little bit easier than a prolonged nonstop running race or biking race is that the format lends itself to thinking in small increments. So you only have to do the swim. You have to get through the bike.
Right.
The bike is always less than 100 miles to go. And then 26 miles is always very doable. So if you only let yourself think about the next, you know, what's in front of your face, you don't have to think about the rest of the week. I think that's the most daunting thing. If you think too big on day 2, 3, 4 about how bad you feel here and extrapolate or think about the next day, you really are just taking one step at a time.
Yeah, breaking things down into smaller chunks is just a huge, a hugely valuable technique.
That's right.
In anything.
Right? That's right.
Yeah.
There's a running quote that I love. I could never run 1,000 miles, but I could run 1 mile 1,000 mm-hmm. times. That's it.
Yeah.
That's how we get through these races.
Yeah, and I think that's how we get through all kinds of things as human beings, and do all kinds of epic things that we as a species have done for millennia.
That's right.
We're in a difficult time, it would appear, now, sort of socially, economically, environmentally, politically, but I'm heartened by all of this type of mindset that many are, that people like you and people that exhibit this type of mindset, because I think we can overcome a variety of challenges as a species by thinking in a similar way.
That's right.
Which does bring me to an area that I did want to talk to you about, and I know that you are, you work in finance, and you don't seem like a banker or I mean that as a compliment. Not to say that you're not great at your job, but I can't help but think that you have taken away certain beliefs, thoughts from the types of things that you've done on the weekends, and the amount of travel that you've done, all the world parts of the world that you've seen around. I mean, what's your day job? What do you do when you're not running? When you're in an office, what types of things do you do?
So my job is a pension fund consultant. Mm-hmm. So we work on behalf of some U.S. public pension plans, some smaller corporate pension plans, endowments and foundations, and try to advise them on a portfolio of funds that is suitable for their mm-hmm. liabilities. So matching assets and liabilities, mm-hmm. and investing in proper managers that meet certain risk and return characteristics. Mm-hmm. So I'm here in London visiting 5 managers a day for the whole week. I've met thousands of managers and funds over the past decade and a half. And I think having perspective before and after the 2008 crisis, having met so many emerging managers and successful ones, it's easier to see what are the characteristics that make good ones, viable ones, and where we can advise our clients to invest their money.
What are some of those characteristics?
Well, I guess there's different aspects to it. From a business perspective, you want an investment team and a non-investment team. You want to have proper infrastructure, proper corporate governance. You want proper experience. You know, we only want to invest with managers who have done it before. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a charity that mm-hmm. they're running. They are investing with the very best. Mm-hmm. So trying to pick out the very best is kind of our job. So that's been, and of course, everyone puts their very best foot forward sells us these fantastic stories. And I think we're not necessarily trying to find managers that will make the most money, but coupled with the managers that will lose the least. Hmm. So these types of ratios are things we look at. Mm-hmm. They're upside to downside performance, for example. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the things that we're looking at. What I think is interesting is I talk to these guys about their portfolios, about what they're investing in. And I may be talking specifically about what equities are invested in, what bonds are invested in, where they think the euro is going. Mm-hmm. And some of these are somewhat short term. They mm-hmm. think Brexit might be a disaster, not necessarily because, for example, they might think China might implode, so they're short the Chinese renminbi. But one of the bigger themes that I think is very interesting is not just about what will happen over the next quarter or the next few years, but what's happening over the next decade.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest themes that lifted markets over the past 10 years was quantitative easing. This collective government action that happened from all of the central banks easing their monetary policy and printing over $20 trillion worth of assets. And quantitative easing, it decreased interest rates, which was supposed to make mortgages and corporate bonds more attractive, to increase housing around the country and around the world, that would lead to more capital development. It should increase stock prices, which would be a virtuous cycle, increase consumer confidence, spur spending, increase profits. What it has done is increase asset prices. And I think this has led to one of the more interesting developments, is that one of the perhaps negative ramifications has been the exacerbation of wealth income inequality in the country,
yes,
which has given rise to populism around the world,
yes,
which gave us Trump and Brexit and unrest in France and Italy and all over Europe. And this is not something that is going away. I read a statistic that if the wealth income inequality continues at the pace it's been at by 2030, the top 1% will own 2/3 of all the assets in the world. And the big problem with this is that we can't achieve potential growth, world growth, with this levels of income inequality that we could. We're not optimizing what we could be achieving. And it's leading to a lot of unrest and a lot of unhappiness in the middle. So these are some of the bigger issues that the managers talk to me about. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily an easy, there's no easy answers. Things are very, very, very complicated. There's not any easy investment decision to be made either.
Yeah, I can imagine involved in pension funds, you are, you know, thinking obviously long term, so you need to be asking these types of questions. It's easy to, it's like that whole Steve Jobs thing of connecting the dots when you kind of go backwards, right, and say, you know, we had all this quantitative easing, and but then, you know, the income inequality, and then thinking through populism and all of those kinds of things are hard for us to, it's hard for us to project forward and think, okay, well, where do we go? Where do we go now?
Right.
I mean, one of the things that I've had a number of guests talk about is just this, what I think that we need to get back to is just focus more on this concept of the truth and facts in our in our discourse. Mm. I mean, our discourse here in the UK about Brexit, you just can't get into it without emotions coming out.
That's right.
And I saw a very factual report from Ireland, just explaining this is what it is, this is what's happened, this is why we have the impasse, but with like very, very dry 4 or 5 minutes of just, not even that, of just an explanation. It was like, it was perfect. This explains it. But you could not produce that report here without some type of uproar around, well, you're clearly owned by these guys, and that kind of thing. And it's very toxic. I feel like we're it's really a challenge to have meaningful, kind of factual, but also interesting conversations with people.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know where we go with it. It's a very in some small way I'm trying to do that with these podcasts, but I think we just need to get better at speaking to one another in a kind of civil way.
Sometimes I remind myself that the world is constantly getting better.
Mm.
You know, it feels like we've taken a step back.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But when you look at people who are living globally, who are living in poverty, when you're looking at longevity of lives, when you're looking about
education levels,
all of these things mm-hmm. have significantly improved mm-hmm. decade over decade mm-hmm. and century over century.
Mm-hmm.
We're right in the middle of it right now, mm-hmm. Where it just seems with Trump and... It seems like we've never been further apart in mm-hmm. in the U.S. at least, just in terms of political ideology.
Yeah.
But it's always been this way.
Yes.
In one sense, it's just very tangible because of social media.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you don't strike me as someone who spends a lot of time on social media because you're so busy with it, which may be a great strategy, right? So folks, get out and run more or do things outside of that realm. That's I think a great solution.
Yeah.
And I think you're inspiring people to do that, but yeah, it's so toxic. It's so difficult to move beyond that. And I think I don't know if you're finding in things like the ultra endurance events, but it seems to me like those things are getting, there are more and more people that are becoming attracted to those types of things.
Oh yeah, I think this has a lot to do with social media.
Yeah,
It just becomes more tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of a sudden, someone that you know has done a marathon, and mm-hmm. you can do it too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very great aspect of social media. You know, people are out doing more things, maybe through peer pressure or inspiration from friends or friend to friends.
Yeah,
But it's also up the ante for these races and these events. And I think, you know, that I almost don't know if it can keep at this level.
At that pace, yeah.
At this pace of people just doing more and more and more and doing one step further than everyone. Or maybe it can.
Maybe it can. Who knows? See. I mean, we in the cycling world, you know, I see more and more people doing these Everesting challenges where you climb a local hill multiple times until you hit the elevation of Everest, loads of challenges. But at the same time, I saw that you are on Strava, but I don't see, you don't seem to me like a Strava junkie, which is this sort of, Strava is this social media platform for endurance athletes.
Yeah, I used it. I haven't.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think it's a little bit private to me.
Yes.
My own training, particularly where I start and end, mm-hmm. right, which is my house.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems a little odd to me that people love to share it. I understand they do. It's for motivational purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't need that for my own training.
It's also very competitive, this idea of KOMs and, you know, being the leader of a certain segment. And where do you stack up to everyone else, which can be, you know, kind of a negative thing.
Yeah, I think it can be. I know for me, I don't need that or want that.
Yeah.
But I love it for the people who use it as a tool to make themselves better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I use it as it's basically my training log. Yeah. But I think the U.S. Was the U.S. Army. They inadvertently displayed where they've got some secret bases last year because of Strava uploads on Strava, it's a fine balance, right? So some of us, you know, one of the great things about endurance sport, which we don't get elsewhere, and certainly in most knowledge jobs, you know, how well am I doing?
Right.
It's hard to know. Whereas, you know, in endurance sport, sort of input versus output, you know, more time on, you know, on your feet, running or riding, equals, you know, tangible results. Yeah. But it's also a way of connecting with ourselves, as I think that those ultra endurance events, ourselves as human beings, because you will come across a difficult moment and you don't really know what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, although I'm not on Strava publicly, I've kept my GPX data for over a decade, all my heart rate data, and I've used that as a training tool, and it's been very, very effective. And I love studying that. One fun project I did was overlay all of the GPX data that I have from all of my runs in Manhattan when I used to live downtown, where I live uptown, onto Google Earth, and to in an attempt to run every single street in Manhattan. So, you know, there's fun things you can have, it's amazing. And I have this great chart when I look at all of my GPX data from all of the runs I've done all over the world. I have the Antarctica data point.
Well,
I have all over
awesome.
All Asia. So that's really, really fun. And it's just so amazing to see, especially when you have heart rate data, you can go back and you can feel that mile. You see the elevation, you know how long it took you, and you know how many beats per minute you were exerting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost like you're reliving that event just by going back to look at these files from 10 years ago, every single training run I've ever done.
So you log every single run?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every single run. Well, I wear this watch, the Garmin, a Garmin Triathlon running watch. It's a step counter and a sleep timer, and it tracks my sleep, and it's my alarm clock. And it's great because anytime I go for a run, which is hopefully twice a day, or I'm feeling lazy, I'm almost monitoring almost all of them.
Yeah, it's amazing what we can do with these devices, and they've really moved. They've moved on, haven't they? I don't know what they were doing 20 years ago, but it must have been a totally different world.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And it helps for me. These watches help me to be accountable to myself.
Yeah.
Even with respect to sleep, because it tracks my sleep every single night, and because I want to get 8 hours of sleep, I know that I'll be accountable to myself, and therefore I have to go to bed by 9 o'clock. So for me, this has been a great tool, a great training tool, and a discipline tool.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a similar one. I use it. I'm not quite as good at sleep as you seem to be. I really struggle with, I'm just not a morning person, and, it's a challenge, but, this is the other frontier is sleep and rest, and we're in recovery. We didn't even talk about recovery. I know we're kind of pushing it for time, but I don't know if you had any thoughts on your recovery, your philosophy on recovery and rest
and
things.
Well, one philosophy I have that has served me well is to do just enough of moderate exertion such that the next day you feel like,
good.
Like feeling good. And I think this is the mistake that a lot of beginning runners make, is that they go to the gym or they do these classes or these spin classes. I did a spin class with my sister 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think I'm still recovering from it. You know, they're yelling, they're barking at you the whole time to go faster and faster. And if you saw what I did on my 2-hour workouts every day, it looks like a walk in the park.
Right.
But the point is that like the very next day,
you do it again. Yeah.
So by the end of the week, you've worked out
more
hopefully
volume.
Every day,
yeah.
And you've done more per day than you would have done otherwise. So that's, you know, it's very, very low impact, but it serves me well for the races that I'm doing, which are very low impact. You know, when I do the Decaman, I imagine my heart rate won't go above 125 beats per minute.
Wow.
for 10 straight days. That's the only way to truly be successful, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of recovery, after a big event, I let myself, I've learned this the hard way, but I let myself tell myself when I'm ready. And for me, knowing that I'm really back is being able to run a tempo run with my track club, you know, on Thursday in the park, where I go for, you know, 6 miles at a really hard effort and feel good. and can run, you know, maybe under 6-minute mile pace for me, which is a, you know, a little bit faster than marathon pace. So that to me is knowing that I'm back. And if I don't feel like doing that, it might take a week, two, and there's no timeline. It might take you, especially after your first marathon or your first ultra marathon, it may take you weeks or months, and there's no playbook to when you should be ready to be back. So recovery for me certainly has a lot to do with rest and sleeping, but I also try to have an active recovery where even the very next day after a long event, usually it will be walking to and from work if it was a super race. But it might be, if it's a medium level race, I'll still try to do a little bit of running. Very, very easy, 10, 11 minute miles. You know, I studied a lot of the Kenyan training philosophy, and it's amazing to see how slow they run. These guys run, you know, the marathon in 4:40, you know, under 5 minutes per mile. And some of their recovery days are close to 10 minutes per mile. And if you just double your race pace, you'd imagine that that's basically walking. That's basically walking for us mortals. And we're not, I'm not doing that. I'm running very easily, but I'm not quite running as slow as they do. So I've ascribed to the Arthur Lydiard school of running, which is like these huge, slow, anaerobic type, aerobic type of fitness levels, and I've just quite enjoyed it. So luckily, like it fits my personality.
Heart rate zone 2 that's type right. of thing,
low heart rate. Yeah, that's right. So maybe once or twice a week, I'll get my heart rate up, but almost always it's in the very low zones.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Also for cycling, I think it's a similar. You know, I think in cycling it's easier to actually keep that heart rate low, I find, because you can keep moving.
That's true.
It's harder on when you're running. But I think those are wise words, because I think there are loads of folks who they go out too hard, they do the hard days, you know, too easy, and the easy days too hard, and
that's right.
You're not really getting any quality training in you.
Well, there's a theory called the black hole theory, which I ascribe to for my marathon training. And it's simply exactly this philosophy that most runners run their easy days too fast and their hard days not fast enough, such that if I'm trying to run a 6-minute mile in the marathon as my marathon goal pace, all of my hard training should be at 6 minutes or faster. And actually, maybe the long runs might be 1 minute, a little bit 1 minute slower, but call it 7-minute pace. The black hole then is between 7-minute pace and 9-minute pace. So if you're ever running between, if I'm ever running between 7-minute and 9-minute pace, I'm not running fast enough to give any aerobic benefit or slow enough to recover. So that's why all my easy days are at 9-10 minute pace. Usually they're closer to 10, and my fast days are really fast. And the fast days are few and far in between. They're only one or two times per week when I'm running 10 times per week. All 80% of my miles run are at a very, very slow pace. And it also builds up your running economy. It prevents you from being injured for the most part. I found, because you're running so much, you're quite a robust runner, but you're not getting overly injured. You know, sometimes I see the shortcut. Basically, the shortcuts are like the high interval training techniques that people are doing, or just doing these workouts without doing all of the slow runs in between. And I think that people are more prone to get injured without, you know, building your body as a running machine.
Yeah, I think it's the same with things like strength training, and, you know, if you're doing, you know, fewer, you do high reps or high weight reps, then you go until exhaustion, then the next day is going to be complete rubbish.
That's right.
So, you know, you might as well dial it down and consistency. There was a wonderful article, this guy Brad Solberg that I was mentioning, which I'll send you the link to, and I'll put it in the show notes. It's I forget the headline exactly, but it's being good enough is the key to being great, or something along those lines, where it makes pretty much the same point. Consistency is the key. And you have to go at a certain level and intensity to maintain that consistency. So
I like
makes
it.
A lot of sense.
Yeah,
We've been going for a while. Was there anything that we didn't get to cover that you wanted to mention here?
No, I think we've been pretty thorough. This has been great. Thank you.
No, thank you. Before we do go, was there anything that you wanted to call out in terms of, like, are you on social media? Are you on any? If people want to know a little bit more about who you are and follow you anywhere, do you do that sort of thing?
You know, I don't really have any any call outs here. Yeah. I'm on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I'm on Facebook as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. But people can, I suppose, follow you on the Decaman. I'm not sure when this episode will go out. So it might go out right around that time, actually. So we'll look out for that. But Chris, this was awesome.
Thank you, Ben. It was awesome.
Thank you very much. And next time you're around, would love to have you back and chit-chat some more. But thanks very much for this.
Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed that, and I am pleased to report that Chris successfully completed the Decaman. He called it the longest, toughest, and most unpredictable race of his life. As always, do check out the show notes to learn a bit more about Chris and his adventures. There are also plenty of things to look forward to here at All Things Risk, including our Best of 2018 episode, our look at the big risks in 2019, more courses, webinars, and other things. Don't miss anything by signing up to our mailing list at allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk. That is it for now. We will be back in 2 weeks. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.